Hey everyone, this is Mark Longhurst, your Living School Alumni Newsletter curator, and this is an interview that I recorded with Center for Action and Contemplation's Executive Director, Michael Poffenberger. In this conversation, we discuss topics such as what led him to work with the CAC, how he encountered Father Richard's work, the CAC's future state vision, and the new DEI, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion process. I also ask him about what mystic he's learning from, and Michael shares some poignant reflections about Father Richard and his upcoming book. I hope you enjoy. So, hey, Michael, thanks for doing an interview for the Living School alumni community. So glad to talk to you today.
Thank you, Mark. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm sure that most of the alumni community knows you, has likely met you, but part of the goal here is to give a sense of where you come from, what you're excited about with the CAC, and what your leadership is like, and also to give alumni a picture of what's developing for the future of this organization that we all care so much about, the Center for Action and Contemplation. First, I'd like to jump in and ask about you. How long have you been at the CAC, and what brought you to this position?
Well, I've been here 4 years now. I packed up my truck June 1st of 2014 and drove across country kind of at the last minute to start off as a consultant to the board. We were going through a transitional period, and I had been on the board, and they had asked for some help. And so that's when I arrived. I became executive director a few months later. I realized when I arrived here just what a huge and inspiring vision, you know, Richard has for this place, and I knew it had impacted me deeply on a personal level, but I really caught that sense of the vision and the scope of what was possible for the future. And so when the board asked if I'd be interested in applying for the job, you know, I did. It was really exciting. And to me, the only real question is whether I'm actually equipped for it, because I think it's such a big and important work right now. Before I packed up my truck, I'd run an organization, a human rights organization in D.C. that did policy work for the decade prior to that. And, you know, Richard's men's spirituality work had really become my primary kind of spiritual community for that. But I was really much more oriented towards, you know, seeking structural change in our world. But I've had a long kind of fascination with the mystics. I grew up in a mixed Catholic and Protestant family. And when I was in college, I took spring break of my freshman year. At the last minute, I had a trip that was canceled, and some friends invited me to take a road trip to Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky, where Thomas Merton had lived. So I spent a week at Gethsemane and was really, really impacted by Merton, and then have kind of maintained a standing interest in study of the mystics since then.
You mentioned that you were familiar with Richard Rohr's work before you came to the CAC. Can you give an example of how his work touched your life before coming?
Yeah, I mean, I'd known of Richard, you know, probably, I don't know when, but I'm sure sometime during my college experience. I was really involved in communities kind of at that intersection in the Catholic world of kind of deep spirituality and social justice. And, you know, I was involved with the Catholic Worker in town and other kinds of programs like that. But when Richard's work really came to the fore, I had I was in D.C. and experienced this real kind of just I reached the end of my own kind of capacities to be an agent of change based on my own willpower, you know. And I felt just absolutely dried up. I mean, a kind of a classic case of burnout when you realize that the world's not going to change to your demands of it, you know. And a really close mentor of mine, who was one of the founders and is still on staff at the Sojourners Committee, this guy Bob Sabbath, encouraged me to look into the men's rites of passage. And so I did that, and you know, and I think it really gave me two things. It gave me one, a reintroduction into kind of the discipline of contemplative practice and contemplative practice in community that I became more dedicated to after that. Started a small group with some friends and really dove down that road. And then two, I think Richard's work on, particularly with the male journey, I think around how we deal with power and powerlessness. And I think, you know, in the activist community in particular, this is one of the wounds that is hidden and needs to be healed around, because power is an instrument of pursuing the things that we care about. And so how you marry that to this spiritual path of descent and this capacity to own and integrate the reality of our own finiteness, the reality of our own powerlessness, ultimately, you know, I think Richard's men's work teaches just beautifully on that, and I could feel how much that was a balm that I needed to be working with much more deeply. And so those are the teachings that really got me started. And since then, obviously, I've been inspired by the whole broader kind of scope and range of his almost impossible, I would say, scope of the work that he's done over the last 40 years.
Could you share about what the future state vision is and what you're excited about?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when I came into the position, the board really tasked me with the primary question of discerning what's the future, if any, beyond Father Richard. And so we spent a really dedicated year and a half process of discernment and consultation focused on that question. And I would say, I think that the danger with any organization as tied to its founder as we are is that we can't think past our founder in the sense that our future is just tied to the person of the founder and not tied to the animating spirit and vision that really, you know, has inspired Richard for all these years. And so that's really what we tried to unpack and understand more deeply through that process. What is that vision and what's the relevance that it has to the world that we face today and to the Christianity that we face today? And so where we landed is really locating CAC's work within this kind of unique historical moment for Western Christianity. You know, Richard has been saying this, but to really own that CAC is about a new reformation. I mean, that's been in our vision statement all along, and I don't know that we've ever institutionally really kind of grappled with what that means. But he really envisions, and we really envision, that we're on the verge of these massive disruptions in terms of how Western Christianity is taught and practiced. And then we think that's a very good thing, and then we think that drawing on the kind of mystical dimensions of Christianity, as Richard and our other faculty have done, is the key to our future, to a future of a Christianity that's more about a path of transformation than a system of beliefs, to put it, you know, succinctly. And so what we're trying to do, what the Future State Vision envisions for us, is to provide one embodiment of that. You know, there's going to be a massive landscape of experimentation and innovation that's needed to carry this tradition into the future, to protect the jewels of Christianity's impact on the world and potential impact on the world, and to see that realized in new ways. But our vision is for a kind of a faculty of teachers. So not just Richard, but partnering with a faculty of people who not only study and understand the same kind of depths of Christian history and practice that Richard does, but are living embodiments of it. You know, the kinds of people that we want to learn from, because, you know, we catch as much as we, you know, wisdom is caught, not just taught. And, you know, folks like Jim and Cynthia, who we've been partnering more with in this process. And then also, you know, quite meaningfully build not just a platform for teaching kind of didactic insights and theology, but really a path of transformation and a community of students who are committed to that path. And so building out the infrastructure that we can integrate our teachers into and provide as a community of learning, a community of transformation for a broader community of our audience and our students. And so that's now what we're trying to build, to lay the groundwork for. And I think within that, CAC has this unique kind of Richard is a, you know, Ilya Delio, one of our other guest teachers, referred to him as a vernacular theologian, which is her kind of academic way of saying he's able to take these insights and drill them down at a level where they're really accessible and they're really relevant to people who are, you know, earlier on in their journey of understanding this path, understanding the mystics. And so I think CAC, we really have a responsibility that's part of our role that we want to carry forward. That there's going to be a whole infrastructure, a whole ecosystem of efforts that's needed to help people deepen down the path. But how can we be an amazing front door to that path, an amazing connection for people who are yearning for that longing, whose hearts long for the depth of that path and just need the right first step into it? How can we give them that first step and then orient them towards the depth journey in community with other students? And so that's what we imagine our future role that we're trying to now occupy more directly. And that we think Richard's work has really been, no, we don't think, I mean, Richard himself is saying that that's what his work has always been about.
for alumni who are listening, what role, if any, do they and we play in how the future state vision unfolds?
The Living School started what we refer to it as an experiment in a formation experience grounded in the mystics. You know, Richard has called it an underground seminary, but I think we're realizing it's less a seminary. We're not trying to train pastors. It's more of an underground kind of monastic formation. I think Richard was really humbled. Father Thomas Keating, you know, the founder of Contemplative Outreach, you know, said to Richard during a recent conversation that he feels that the Living School is the only true kind of systematic teaching of the contemplative tradition for lay people that exists, that he sees out there, that we're not just trying to give people one part of the pie, you know, not just the theology, not just some of the practices, not just the history, but all of it in a kind of a comprehensive formation experience that really sets people up to be living on this path in their own contexts. So I think from the beginning, the first and you know, the first and foremost hope for our alumni is that they feel equipped by their experience in the school to sustain that path in their lives beyond the Living School experience, and to do it in a way that helps them be more, you know, effective agents of change, agents of awakening love in our world in each of their contexts. And that through their, you know, relationships formed in the school and the relationships within the alumni, that they can find a community of support, you know, like-minded peers on the path, people who can be sources of encouragement and further wisdom, and even, you know, concrete resources for the many incredible initiatives and the great work that many of our alumni are engaged in the world. And so there's a certain infrastructure to that we still want to build, but our first and foremost hope is just that Living School alumni are equipped with the you know, knowledge, the practices, and the relationships to be on a sustained path of transformation that helps them serve our world more effectively. So I think that's the first hope. And there's definitely a role for us as an institution to just, you know, create the connectivity that enables that to happen. But it's a very limited role, you know, and it's really up to the alumni in a lot of ways to take that initiative and to be on that path themselves. There's a secondary piece that I think is coming clearer as we start implementing the Future State vision. You know, we've waited to organize a really formal structured alumni program out of a kind of a fear that it would become captive to what the alumni, you know, immediately want, you know, which is tends to be more teaching, more contact with the teachers, you know, as opposed to what we think is actually most needed in the broader landscape. And that's not, those two things are obviously not mutually exclusive, but we want to get clear on kind of ends and means before we really try to build the structure of it. And so what we're talking about is that, you know, as we were saying earlier, that if we take this idea that our institution is about, you know, a new reformation, a historical moment of renewal for the Christian tradition, then how can our alumni also be equipped as kind of incubators or innovators or leaders of the diversity of efforts that are going to, you know, be entailed in that? And so we're looking at kind of concrete the frameworks of leadership development. So for those alumni who really do feel, you know, called and equipped to be, you know, concretely trying to develop communities of practice or embodying different forms of leadership that are going to be necessary for this broader kind of ecology of a new reformation to arise. I think that's the one piece that we're now taking more seriously, and how can we build the structures that help for those alum that do feel called into that? How do we help them do that? And I think once we get a little bit clearer on that, then I think we're going to feel much more confident about launching that alumni program kind of structurally. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I'm going to anyways, and just kind of tip off that we're almost finalized on a decision to make Conspire 2019, which is the final Conspire conference in the 7 conference series. So the 7 conferences are all about the seven themes of Richard's alternative orthodoxy that he taught in the Living School. And so the final one is on non-dual consciousness. And so what we're talking about is, instead of just having that be a normal kind of Conspire where we invite everybody, we actually start by making it a pilgrimage for our Living School alum, invite them back to Albuquerque, and really cast the vision in a much more practical way for where we see this work going beyond the lifetimes even of our existing faculty, and invite alumni as participants in that, as contributors to that, as embodiments of that, as the agents of change that we've always been about. And so just to put that on people's radar, to think about Conspire 2019, it's in September, and it would be anchored by our core faculty. So you come back, really organize around that, and have that be a moment of kind of unveiling of our future and an invitation to our community to be a part of that co-creation process.
I'll see you in September 2019, and I hope others will too. Under your leadership, the CAC has recently started a DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion process. The CAC as an organization is going through this process of looking at practices of diversity and widening the scope of inclusion. So can you quickly express what that is and what your hopes for that process are?
Yeah, we're really excited about this. We think it's, like, in a way, we don't want to try to move aggressively into a future without doing this hard work first, without being on a serious learning journey around diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I would say, even though, one of the bedrocks of mystical teaching is this idea of the underlying unity of all things, the reality is that I think we haven't done enough to ask ourselves the hard questions of why, even though we teach that, our community tends to resemble very specific people with very specific kinds of life experiences, and especially those that resemble, in some respects, the social location and context of our teachers. And so to get more specific about that, mostly baby boomer generation, overwhelmingly white, and surprisingly wealthy, upper middle class, wealthy types of folks tend to be our average audience. And I think it just provokes us to ask, we have to be asking these hard questions about why is it that the work appeals or is mostly accessible to people, who come from those experiences, and what does that have to say about what's working and not working in our teaching? To what extent are we living into the embodiment of what we're saying about the nature of reality, and to what extent are we not? And I think, as we began to ask those questions, our sense became increasingly that though we teach that, and that there's a natural way that we don't have to apologize for that. In a lot of ways, people are drawn to teachers who share their own context and can speak to that context capably. And so there's a certain degree to which that's just been a natural evolution of our work. But I also really want to be clear in acknowledging that we have massive institutional blind spots and teaching blind spots that are leading us, I think, to unintentionally reinforce the structures of privilege and oppression that we're participating in, even as we teach in a way that tries to undermine them. And so as we really have come to terms with that acknowledgement, what we did is we searched for a set of outside partners who could help us do a really rigorous kind of from the ground up learning journey about how we think, talk, and participate in these structural issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and be on a journey of transformation as an organization. My hope, so we did that. We went on a 6-month search process. We had an incredible set of consulting partners apply and that we vetted, and we have these incredible partners now, all three of whom are graduates of Divinity School, two of whom I would say describe themselves as students of Richard and the CAC, and whose full-time jobs are focused on organizational transformation around issues of equity and inclusion. And so my hope is that, that our lived reality, that our lived embodiment reflects what we teach, that people experience us as a place that celebrates God's location in everyone and everything, and in that way that we really embody a level of inclusivity that I think we haven't, and that our work helps people develop critical lenses and be agents of this work themselves, and that's the equity piece where we want people to come out of our work being more equipped and not just reinforced in their existing kind of lenses and ways of perceiving things.
So who's a mystic that's inspiring you today, whether an ancient mystic or a living mystic? And here you are working with three of the most exciting mystics in our country, I think. Who's inspiring you?
Yeah, thanks for giving me that out. The reality is that the demands of this job and then being a new dad, my daughter's 2.5 years old now, keeping up with our existing faculty and then a reading list of, helping me be from the organizational management side is about the extent of my reading time. It's really Richard, Jim, and Cynthia. And the latest that we've been working through, we had an internal team work through the manuscript of Richard's next book in preparation, kind of how do we think about supporting it and really as an organization getting behind the message in the book. And I have to say I am more excited about this piece of work than anything Richard has ever done before. I think it's going to be a really defining part of his legacy that he's leaving behind. So the book title that's still kind of to be confirmed is Another Name for Everything, The Universal Christ. And it's Richard's kind of master synthesis of Christianity. To be a Christian is to see the sacredness in all things, that the Christ is as the coherence of matter and spirit that has been there since the Big Bang for 13 billion years. And just the radical implications that has for how we understand our tradition and Jesus' significance in that context. So it's a brilliant piece of work. Penguin Random House is publishing it, and it gives us this amazing foundation for, a brilliant encapsulation of the theology that we want to be about as an organization as we move forward. And he wrote it in this kind of, you think it's a very heady topic, but he did a better job on this book than I've ever seen him do, leading you into it from the standpoint of experiencing it, to invite you into a dialogue that reflects on your own experience as you're reading the text. You know, he of course, as he always does, brings in the historical and the exegetical and the scriptural and uses that to buttress the argument, but really locates it within the context of people's own lived spiritual journeys. It's such an exciting project. We have huge plans around how to support it, and it was really impactful for me to get to read it first. But yeah, on that note of how I'm learning from them, I think, the thing that everybody always wants to know is what's it like working with Richard, and of course, there's the parts of it that are just we're running an organization, and then there's the moments when, it does break through that you're sitting in the presence of somebody who just has this lens on life and the world and their own experience, and you see it in real time in ways that are really impactful, and it's an insane. I mean, it's just an enormous privilege to be around. And Richard, I think, as everybody knows, has been going through. A series of health challenges, his prostate cancer, he had a heart attack, over the Christmas break. And all of our teachers are in this advancing age, but to be up close and especially with Richard, who's here, in our offices most days, as he comes to terms with his own mortality and his own limitations, his own fears, but also just this sense of courage and peace and really allowing. It's that spirit of allowing that I see of just whatever is and is welcome, is to be welcomed, he's really embodied that. It's been a really sweet and kind of vulnerable process that he's been through, and to be up close to that is something I know is going to be something I'll be reflecting on probably for the rest of my life.
Well, I know I speak for many of us when I say we've been so touched by his ministry and his presence and his teaching, as well as Cynthia and Jim, but it's very moving to hear you reflect on that and working so closely with a living teacher mystic. So thanks for sharing that, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, and thanks to all the alumni who've been faithfully carrying out this work in your own context. It's so inspiring to hear from many of you, and your work is what gives us hope and energy, for ours. So thank you to everybody and for all the good work to come, just so excited for what's still ahead.